Paul Goldbart suggested I give a overview of quantum information theory, so I chose this rather audacious title, hoping I'd come up with a talk to match the title. I may not have succeeded very well, but I will tell you about some recent developments that I hope you'll find interesting. It seems to me that in the last couple of years, we've begun to understand much better some of the ways in which quantum systems are different from classical systems. And one way that's happening is we're deriving insights from thinking about how we can put the weirdness of quantum mechanics to work. That is, asking what kind of tasks can be performed by exploiting unusual properties of quantum information, tasks that couldn't be performed in a classical world. And this field of quantum information science has some interesting achievements to its credit: fast quantum algorithms, unconditionally secure cryptographic protocols, error correction schemes that can resist the effects of decoherence, and the heroic pioneering efforts to achieve coherent manipulation of quantum states in the laboratory. And some of the challenges faced by the field are to do more of the same. Find more algorithms. What else can quantum computers do much better than classical computers? Find new cryptographic protocols where quantum effects give enhancements in security. Find ways to realize error correction physically and conceive and build hardware that's potentially scalable to large devices. And these are interesting and exciting challenges. But you can ask, where's the physics in it? In a way, it kind of seems like the computer scientists are setting the agenda. Computer scientists think about computation and cryptography and error correction. It's rather distant from the problems that physicists typically think about. But I feel that there is considerable potential for the recent work on quantum information to make contact with questions that are closer to the core of physics. And for dramatic effect, I've associated three areas in which I see that potential with aphorisms from the mouths of famous physicists. The problem of understanding fundamental particle physics from a computer scientist perspective is the problem of understanding what's the right computational model that's actually realized in nature. The problem of understanding phases in condensed matter is, in a sense, an investigation of the computational complexity of that model. And, well, many people have felt for a long time that an information theoretic perspective can give us a deeper understanding of the foundations of quantum theory. And just to be a little bit more specific for a moment, in struggling with the question, what is M-theory, I think it may be very useful to think about how do you simulate M-theory, and in particular, how would you get a quantum computer to simulate processes in quantum gravity. And a fascinating question is whether a quantum computer really can simulate M-theory efficiently. I think it's reasonably plausible that that's not possible because of the inherent non-locality in some processes in quantum gravity involving the quantum physics of black holes. And if it's not possible, that's really interesting because it means the actual computation, if you believe M-theory is right, the actual computational model realized in nature may be more powerful than the one that we're currently investigating in studies of quantum computing. And in trying to understand the robust universal properties of phases of matter, a question, I guess you have to have a particle physics background to put it this way, but you can wonder whether there can be a final theory of the phases of quantum systems. If we, from a computer scientist perspective, what we're interested in are the quantum states we can build with reasonable resources. And one wonders whether there's really some exhaustive classification of the interesting kinds of quantum states, whether investigating the frontiers of Hilbert space will eventually become boring. And a question about the foundations of quantum theory that I think is really interesting is what kinds of deformations away from quantum mechanics are possible. How can we tweak our computational model a little bit so that it still makes sense but leads to different conclusions? But for this talk, I'm going to try to contain my susceptibility to spouting unsupported speculation. And I won't talk about these things, but tell you about some of the recent developments in the field and these central themes of quantum information, starting with computation. Well, quantum computing is the idea that if we perform a computation acting on quantum states instead of classical bits, we can perform tasks that would be impossible with digital computers. Like factoring this number, which is really hard for a classical computer, but for a quantum computer is really easy, not much harder than multiplying two numbers together. It's an amazing thing, I think. It's one of the most exciting ideas I feel I've heard, that the difference between what is a hard problem and what is an easy problem is different because the world is quantum mechanical than it would be if this were a classical world. But we've known about factoring for 9 years. And I think the most important question in this whole field might be, what is the power of quantum computing? What can quantum computers do? And what are we learning about that in the last couple of years? So to explain that, let me go back and give a little background on what we understood about quantum computing way back in the 90s. A setting in which we can establish a sharp separation between quantum and classical computing power is one that a computer scientist called the black box model or the Oracle model. And the idea is that there is some black box and it computes a function, and we don't know what that function is initially, but we can query the box, we can give it an input, and it will spit out the function evaluated at that input. And our task is to figure out what the box is doing, to find out what function it's evaluating, or to learn some property of that function with a minimal number of queries of the Oracle. And there's a natural quantum version of the black box model in which the black box is doing some unitary transformation. And on a particular computational basis, that unitary transformation is really just evaluating a function and adding the value of the output to an output register. And we can imagine that we submit to the box only queries which are classical, that is, are these computational basis states, just strings of zeros and ones, or we can allow more general quantum queries, which are superpositions of the basis states. And for many problems, we know that we can achieve an exponential speed up in solving the problem if we're allowed to use quantum queries compared to the case where only classical queries are allowed. And a rather general scheme in which that works is called the hidden subgroup problem, where we imagine that the input to the function is the element of some group. The function maps the group to a set. And the function, we are promised, has the property of being constant and distinct on the cosets of the group. So it takes all the elements of a given coset to a particular output. And if two inputs are in different cosets, it maps them to different outputs. And our problem is to figure out what is this subgroup, the hidden subgroup H, and with a minimal number of queries of the box. And classically, this can be a hard problem if there are an exponentially large number of cosets. We might have to query the box very many times before we get the same output twice and start to learn something about the structure of the subgroup. But quantumly, at least in the case where the group G is a finitely generated abelian group, it's an easy problem, and we can solve it with a number of queries which just grows polynomially with the log of the number of cosets. And the way we can do that is that quantum computers can efficiently evaluate a quantum Fourier transform. So there's a general strategy for solving this kind of problem, which is we start out with a state which I can think of as the trivial representation of the group, and I execute the Fourier transform, and that turns this state into this uniform superposition of all the elements of the group. And then we query the oracle, and it evaluates the function. And it makes this quite interesting state in which there are correlations between the input register and the output register. So to try to simulate classically the production of the state would be hard because it has information encoded in it about the value of the function for an exponentially large number of inputs. But quantumly, it's easy to make. And then we can imagine measuring the output register, getting some particular output, and that prepares in the input register a uniform superposition of all the elements of a coset, because remember, the function was constant and distinct on the cosets. And then when I have the superposition of all the elements of a coset, I can do an inverse Fourier transform. And then I get, up to some phases, a uniform superposition of all the elements of the group dual to the hidden subgroup that we're looking for. It's like finding the reciprocal lattice of a lattice when we do the Fourier transform. And then I can measure this register, and then I'm sampling this dual group, and I learn something about it. And repeating this a modest number of times, I get enough information to completely reconstruct the hidden subgroup, and that's how we solve it. And that's really what Shor did in his 1994 paper for the problem of finding the period of a function, because it turns out that there's a reduction of the factoring problem to the problem of finding the period of a function that we can evaluate ourselves efficiently. So in this case, the oracle is our own evaluation of the function, which we can do quickly. And the problem to solve is, what is the period of this function? So the hidden subgroup is the group consisting of all the integer multiples of that period that we want to find. And so it's just a hidden subgroup problem, an abelian hidden subgroup problem. And actually, the group G in this case is an infinite group, and we can't really do the Fourier transform over an infinite group, but it's okay because we can consider instead the cyclic group for sufficiently large n and use the same method and get the answer efficiently with high probability. And most of the known cases in which a quantum computer gives us an exponential speed up over classical algorithms involve this same bag of tricks, solving a hidden subgroup problem using the efficient quantum Fourier transform. And we know it works for finitely generated abelian groups. So what's happened in the last year or two? So here's one development in the last 2 years. A quantum algorithm was discovered by Sean Halgren for this problem of solving Pell's equation, which is the problem of finding integer solutions to x squared minus dy squared equals 1, where d, the input to the problem, is an integer that's not a perfect square. It's a very old number theoretic problem. And it seems, in a certain sense, to be harder than factoring, and that the best known classical algorithms for solving Pell's equation are exponentially slower than the best known classical algorithms for factoring. And Halgren showed that it could be solved efficiently on a quantum computer in a time order exponential. Oh, I see. You're right. That's the classical time I'm looking at. In a time which is a polynomial in the number of digits of the number d. So one way of looking at this is it's really another hidden subgroup problem, but of a different kind, because it's not a finitely generated group. This problem can be reduced to finding the period of a function which has inputs in real numbers where the period is irrational. And Halgren's work showed that we can extend the same general method to the case where the group isn't finitely generated.
Is this problem NP-hard?
It's not NP-hard as far as, it's not believed to be NP-hard, right. Okay, so the other frontier you might think of is, what about non-abelian groups? There are a lot of applications and algorithms to non-abelian hidden subgroup problems, and there's been some progress in the last couple of months on that. In particular, for the case of the dihedral group, that is the symmetry group of a polygon with capital N sides, where the number of sides is exponentially large. This is just a little bit non-abelian in the sense that the irreducible representations of the group are all either one or two dimensional. But it's non-abelian enough to be interesting, because if we consider the hidden subgroup to be the two-element group generated by a non-trivial reflection about some axis of symmetry of the polygon, then all the possible hidden subgroups, all the possible reflections, are related to one another by conjugation. And that makes them harder to distinguish than hidden subgroups in the abelian setting. It turns out there are some one-dimensional representations of the group that can give us some useful information if we apply the Fourier transform and the sampling method that I described before about what this non-trivial reflection is. But those representations are exponentially unlikely to come up when we do sampling, and the other representations aren't very informative. So an idea that Greg Cooperberg discussed recently is we can kind of navigate our way through the space of irreducible representations to get to the ones that give us some useful information. That is, we can do this Fourier transform method a number of times and get a bunch of irreducible representations that in principle we could sample, but we fuse them together to see what representations we get in the product, and then we either keep what we get or throw it away, and then proceed in another round of, we iterate that procedure, and we can kind of maneuver around in the space of irreducible representations to move towards the ones that we like that give us some information. And that turns out to allow us to solve the dihedral hidden subgroup problem with a significant speedup. Classically, you can show that in this black box setting, it takes a time which is exponential in little n, and Cooperberg's method brings that down to exponential in the square root of n. But it still hasn't been established that that can be improved to a polynomial in little n. But it's encouraging, at least, that here is an interesting non-abelian case in which we know the quantum computing bag of tricks that have been developed are powerful. And this problem actually is interesting in itself. One problem with cryptographic applications is finding the shortest vector on a lattice if you're given a list of the generators of the lattice, and that can actually be reduced to solving the dihedral hidden subgroup problem. Here's an example of something of a recent development that doesn't have anything to do with the hidden subgroup problem, but another kind of exponential speedup. In classical algorithms, there are a lot of applications of random walks on graphs, and it's natural to wonder whether if we do a quantum walk on a graph instead, that can give us some additional computational power. And these guys, the MIT group, discussed an example where that's the case. The problem they considered is, we take two bifurcating trees, one on the left, one on the right, we glue them together with a random cycle, and we assign random names to all the nodes on the graph, including, and we're told the name of this entrance node over on the left, and the problem is to find out the name of the exit node over on the right. And classically, this problem is hard because if we start wandering around on the graph, we keep diffusing back to the center where almost all the nodes are, and it's really hard to find the exit. But quantumly, if we have an oracle which, when we query it with the valid name of a node, it tells us who the neighbors are, then we can use that oracle to simulate Schrodinger evolution on the graph governed by a Hamiltonian that couples together the adjacent sites. And then you can make a wave packet over by the entrance and send it on its way, and it can zip right through the graph and find the exit quite quickly. So with an exponential speedup, it can solve this problem because of the ways in which quantum walks differ from classical walks on graphs. But the problem is pretty contrived, and it's still not known whether there are examples which are of more intrinsic interest in which quantum walks give you exponential advantages over classical walks. Well, one of the things that we're interested in that we think quantum computers can do is one of the oldest ideas, which Feynman suggested over 20 years ago, that with a quantum computer we can simulate other quantum systems efficiently. When we try to simulate real-time evolution of a many-body quantum system, typically there's an exponential slowdown, and we can do better by having one quantum system behave like another one, that is, by simulating it on a quantum computer. And I just wanted to emphasize that in a way, the era that Feynman envisioned of quantum simulation has already begun last year with this experiment by Greiner et al. Based on theoretical proposals by Yaksh and Zoller and others, in which they simulated the Mott transition in an optical lattice filled with the Bose-Einstein condensate. So this is a system which can be, you know, controlled with very significant precision, in which we can actually dial a microscopic Hamiltonian and study interesting coherent many-body effects. And it's a kind of quantum simulator. And it'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years what kinds of interesting many-body coherent phenomena can be successfully simulated using this method. There are a lot of things that, in principle, you could do. By controlling spin-dependent tunneling between sites, you can get a lot of interesting potentially exotic phases. So the last thing I wanted to talk about in connection with quantum algorithms is the adiabatic method for quantum computing, which has been discussed in the last couple of years starting with Farhi et al. At MIT. So an example, as we heard in the last talk, of an NP-hard problem is finding the ground state of an ionizing spin glass in three dimensions, where we define an instance of the problem by specifying for which neighboring site the coupling is ferromagnetic and for which it's anti-ferromagnetic. And it's hard to find the ground state classically by locally searching or by doing simulated annealing because there are so many local minima of the energy for the hard instances, so equilibration times are exponentially long. Well, in principle, a quantum algorithm might be able to do better by tunneling through the barriers separating the local minima, which stymie a local classical search. And for example, we could try to find the ground state by adiabatic quantum evolution. If we consider a Hamiltonian which smoothly interpolates in the space of Hamiltonians from a starting Hamiltonian whose ground state is easy to construct, like a large transverse field in which the ground state has all the spins polarized, from there to a problem Hamiltonian whose ground state encodes NP-hard information, then we could start out close to the ground state of the beginning Hamiltonian and adiabatically let it evolve to the Hamiltonian of the problem Hamiltonian, and then we could read out the answer by, say, measuring all the spins along the z-axis. And as long as the running time is long enough, as long as we go sufficiently slowly, we'll wind up in the ground state with high probability and we'll be successful. Now the critical issue is, how slowly do you have to go? And the answer is determined by how small the gap becomes during the evolution between the ground state and the first excited state. And as long as the gap stays larger than 1 over some polynomial, in the size of the input to the problem, then this is a good algorithm, and it's actually a polynomial time algorithm for finding the answer. And we lose only if the gap gets exponentially small. So the issue isn't whether there's a quantum phase transition, whether the gap collapses. We take that for granted. The issue is really one of a finite size scaling. How does the gap behave as the system size grows?
And, why do you need quantum computer to solve this quantum problem?
Why do I need a quantum computer?
No, if you reduce it to a quantum problem, a simple Hamiltonian, you probably can solve it by conventional.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, so that's what it says at the bottom here, that we can simulate this with any old quantum computer. So if the method works, then if you have a universal quantum computer, then you can solve the problem efficiently using your quantum computer, just by simulating this evolution. So any problem for which the gap stays larger than 1 over a polynomial in this setting is a problem that any universal quantum computer can solve efficiently. Okay. So the MIT group investigated this by looking at relatively small instances of problems that are NP complete, but they made the instances as hard as they could. They tried to pick the hard instances for relatively small input size. And for a particular NP complete problem that they studied, they could diagonalize the Hamiltonian numerically up to an input size of 10 bits. And of course, in the middle of the spectrum, the level spacings are very small because there are a very large number of levels. But at the bottom, the gap stays reasonably large. And they were able to go a little bit further just by doing the, on a classical computer, simulating the real-time Schrodinger evolution for input sizes up to 20 bits. And look at how slowly they had to run in order to get the answer to the problem with some fixed probability of success, and they found a runtime needed that growed, that's a pretty good fit to growing quadratically with the size of the input to the problem. It doesn't look anything like exponential growth, but they couldn't go any farther than these small instances because these were the biggest systems they could simulate easily on classical computers.
Yeah. Which problem is this?
It's actually called the exact cover problem. It's a problem, it's a kind of satisfiability problem in which there are clauses which each involve three of the input bits and an exact cover in order for the assignment to be satisfying, exactly one out of each of the three bits in the clause has to have the value 1, and the other two have to have 0. So they randomly generated instances, and they chose the number of clauses so there was a unique satisfying assignment to try to make the problem as hard as possible. Typically, you have to have about n clauses if there are n input bits for that to be the case.
So here you have about 10 variables.
Sorry?
How many variables do you have in this problem, in the instances that they consider?
For this problem, they considered up to 20 bits, right? And they had some number of clauses which was of order, 10 or 20, and chosen in such a way that there was just one satisfying assignment. And then they asked, how long do I have to run as I increase the size of the problem? Here, this is actually going from a 10-bit input up to a 20-bit input. And they fixed the success probability, I think, at 1/8, and they asked, okay, how does t have to scale so that I get the right answer with a fixed probability? It's a little bit easier to handle numerically than actually studying the gap directly. Okay. On the other hand, there are cases that are known which you can formulate in which the gap does get exponentially small at some point during the evolution, and examples of that have been given by Van Dam et al. And when this happens, there's a kind of easy way of understanding it. Yeah?
Sorry. Is it obvious that for a system with a very large Hilbert space, that just having a add to the gap is sufficient?
Yeah. Actually, so there's a version of the adiabatic theorem which goes back about 50 years that works even if you have continuous spectrum above the gap. Yeah, and the way you analyze that is you consider tweaking the Hamiltonian a little bit so that you stay exactly in the ground state, and then you ask how big is the perturbation of the Hamiltonian that makes that true, and then you can get a bound depending on how big that perturbation is on how close the real evolution is to the evolution in which you stay exactly in the ground state. And all that doesn't depend on the density of levels above the gap, but just on the gap being sufficiently large.
Even robust, if you have an exponentially large number of levels.
Even an infinite number. It could be continuous spectrum. Yeah.
I think that for spin glasses, you can show that the gap is exponential.
OK, well, this. Well,
and there's a simple argument. Even the evolution itself, if you write it as a diffusion equation, you can think of it itself as another quantum problem. And because simulated anything doesn't work, you know that the gap is true for that new problem. So
you're saying from knowing that the classical algorithm isn't efficient?
You already construct as many counterexamples as you want.
Okay, well, this would be very interesting for me to learn more about. Maybe you can tell me later. So anyway, there are cases in which you can demonstrate that there's an exponentially small gap, but they typically have a simple interpretation that at some point during the evolution there's a classical degeneracy with a barrier separating the classical minima that's hard to penetrate. But there are other cases in which one can see that simulated annealing, for example, fails because of local minima, but the adiabatic algorithm does well because the barriers are sufficiently easy to penetrate that you can still find the real ground state with a high probability of success. And there's a recent result, the details of which I haven't seen because they haven't appeared, but which has been announced, that this method of adiabatic evolution with a local Hamiltonian is as powerful as the standard model of quantum computation, even if the interactions are just local. That is, any problem that we can solve efficiently with an ordinary quantum computer can, if we set it up the right way, be solved by finding the ground state of some Hamiltonian via adiabatic evolution. So we could solve the factoring problem, for example, this way. And therefore, it would be a very I'm not sure what the conclusion would be if you could show that if this method succeeds, the classical algorithm would also succeed. It would be like showing that factoring is easy classically. Okay, so quantum cryptography, I'm not going to have much time to discuss. Of course, it's the idea that by using quantum states, we can achieve a higher level of security that's possible in classical cryptography. That in quantum cryptography, we can found privacy on principles of fundamental physics instead of, as in most of classical cryptography, on assumptions about the resources that are available to our adversary. And there have been recent developments in the last year or two in our understanding of the security of quantum cryptographic protocols. But I'll be content just to say that, just to make the comment, that the technology of quantum cryptography is far more advanced than the technology of quantum computing. And there are actually systems now that are commercially available. You can go to this website and place your order for a quantum key distribution system that promises absolute security. The distance over which quantum key distribution can be done is currently limited by the losses in optical fibers. The record, I think, is a successful key distribution protocol carried out through an optical fiber under Lake Geneva at a range of 67 kilometers. And one of the big challenges is to use ideas of quantum error correction to extend that range to longer distances. Okay, so let me talk about quantum entanglement, the idea that correlations among parts of a quantum system are stronger than classical correlations. So the Bell inequality, which first established this, we can think of as in terms of a game that two parties, Alice and Bob, are playing, in which they share an unlimited amount of classical randomness, and each receives an input. Alice receives X, Bob receives Y, but Bob doesn't know X and Alice doesn't know Y, and they're supposed to produce an output, A for Alice and B for Bob. And the object of the game is for Alice and Bob to choose their output bits such that their XOR is equal to the AND of the two input bits. So in other words, they're supposed to output the same bit unless X and Y are both 1, and then they're supposed to output opposite bits. And you can show that if the input bits are uniformly distributed, there's no strategy that allows you to play the game more successfully than a success probability of 3/4. But if Alice and Bob have an entangled pair of qubits, if they have a Bell pair, a maximally entangled state, then they can do better and boost the probability of success to a little over 85%. So there are things you can do if you have entanglement that you can't do without it, and we've come to think of entanglement as a resource which enables two parties who are separated from one another to perform tasks that would otherwise not be possible, like quantum teleportation. Now, one thing we'd like to do with entanglement is quantify it. How much entanglement does one have? And in the case of bipartite pure state entanglement, when two parties share a pure quantum state, there's a very nice way of doing that. So imagine Alice and Bob have some state psi that they share, and we want to answer the question, how entangled is this state? So what we can imagine doing is, suppose that Alice and Bob actually have many copies of this state, n copies. And Alice has half of each copy, and Bob has half of each copy. And we allow Alice and Bob to perform local operations, unitaries and measurements, each in his or her own laboratory. And we allow them to send classical information back and forth, so Alice can perform some operation conditioned on Bob's measurement and vice versa. And then in carrying out all this communication, they manage to distill from the original n copies of the state psi that they started with some number k copies of a maximally entangled pair of qubits, this EPR pair. And the best way they can do this, the maximal number of EPR pairs that they can acquire from the n copies of psi that they started, that's a kind of measure of entanglement. And then asymptotically, if we consider taking the limit of n getting very large and looking at the ratio of the maximum number of EPR pairs that they can get out, that's something which is quite easy to calculate. It's just the same thing as the von Neumann entropy of the density operator that Alice has if we trace over Bob's half of the state, or that Bob has if we trace over Alice's half. So that's the amount of entanglement, the number of EPR pairs they can distill from the state, and it's a natural measure of how much entanglement they started with. All the more so because the whole thing is reversible. Not only can they get k EPR pairs out of the n copies of the state they started with, but through local operations and classical communication, they can undo the process and take the EPR pairs and turn them back into copies of psi without losing anything asymptotically. So we can measure entanglement according to how many EPR pairs they need to make their state, or how many EPR pairs they can get from the state, and it's the same number, and it's given by this von Neumann entropy. Now, in the case of bipartite mixed states, things are more complicated in several ways. So first of all, what do we mean by entanglement? We say the state is separable if it's something that two parties can make, if they don't start out with any entanglement, through only local operations and classical communication. So it's just some probabilistic mixture of product states. So Alice and Bob can flip a coin and decide to each prepare based on the coin flip, a pure state in his or her laboratory, and then the state is separable. If it doesn't have that property, then it's an entangled state, one that can't be made just with local operations and classical communication. One thing we've known for a while, but it was surprising when it was found, was that being entangled is not the same thing as violating a Bell inequality. It's possible for a state which is non-separable to still be amenable to a local hidden variable description of the possible measurements that Alice and Bob could perform. An example of that is a state of two qubits, which with some probability f is the singlet state of two qubits, and with probability 1 minus f is a triplet state where we don't know which triplet state. And that state is actually non-separable. It's an entangled state if this f is greater than 1/2. But f has to be larger than that for it to become Bell inequality violating. If f is less than 5/8, then it has a local hidden variable description. So what about quantifying mixed state entanglement? Well, we can use the same idea I described before. There's an entanglement cost, which is the number of EPR pairs that we would need asymptotically, the minimum number, to make a copy of the state. And there's a distillable entanglement, the amount of EPR pairs, the maximum number that we can extract through local operations and classical communication from each copy of the state. And as I've already remarked, for pure states, those are the same thing. The entanglement cost is equal to the distillable entanglement, but for mixed states, they're different. The cost in entanglement is greater than the distillable entanglement, the entanglement you can get back. The asymptotic entanglement transformations can actually be irreversible. At least we know that that's true for some mixed states row. And in a way, it's not surprising because you have to discard some information to make the mixed state if you start with pure states, and maybe you shouldn't be able to expect to get that information back. But it was surprisingly difficult to prove this irreversibility, and it was only done in the last 2 years. We even know that there are states which have no distillable entanglement at all. You can't get any EPR pairs back from them through local operations and classical communication, but they do have an asymptotic entanglement cost. So you can't make these states unless you have some entanglement to start with, the so-called bound entanglement. And it's a good question whether this bound entanglement is good for anything. And there is some evidence that there are things that two parties can do if they share bound entanglement that they can't do without it, but the situation is still kind of obscure. Okay, so what about more than two parties? One thing we might want to do is have some natural way of quantifying how much entanglement there is in an n-party pure state. So what about three parties? Now suppose I have three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and each one of them has two qubits. There are two rather different types of entangled states that they could share if they each had two qubits. Each pair of Alice, Bob, and Charlie could have one of these maximally entangled EPR pairs, or they could have two copies of this so-called GHZ or CAT state, which is another kind of entangled three-party state, which whose entanglement is really intrinsically a three-party phenomenon. And so you could ask, all right, well, are these interconvertible? Can we change one to the other? And the answer is no. Asymptotically, it's not possible to take these three EPR states and change them into the two GHZ states or in the other direction. And in fact, even if you have all the EPR states you want and all the CAT states you want, that's not a sufficient resource to, in a reversible manner, prepare any other state shared by three parties. So there isn't yet a very nice way of characterizing how entangled a three-party state is. And as you increase the number of parties, there are always new types of entanglement that arise that you can't make in a reversible manner from entanglement shared by fewer than n parties. So we don't at present have some very natural and nice way of comparing two n-party entangled states and saying which one is more entangled. One thing you can do with m-party mixed states is you can discuss how much room is there around the completely uniform state where all the states are separable. So we know that if m parties have the state whose density operator is completely random, that's certainly separable because they can prepare that by each one of the parties separately preparing a random pure state. But suppose we deviate a little bit from that state. We have a state which with probability 1 minus epsilon is random, and with some small probability epsilon is a pure state shared by the m parties. And then one can say how small epsilon has to be in order for this state to be separable. And it has to be small. It has to get exponentially small as the number of parties increases. Well, one application of this is you can ask for the type of quantum information processing that has been done using liquid state NMR at room temperature. Are the states that are being manipulated separable or entangled? They're actually separable and would be even if we had up to 23 qubits for the typical polarizations that can be achieved at room temperature. And the current world record in NMR quantum information processing is 7 qubits. So these experiments are really manipulating separable states, and it sounds at first like that can't be any better than classical computing. But when you think about it, that's actually not so obvious. And there isn't a way known of simulating the computation that's performed on a highly mixed state, even if the state is separable. And we still don't have a very clear answer to the question, just how powerful is quantum computing that acts on highly mixed states. But coming back to pure states, there is something kind of interesting you can say about pure states which are not too entangled. So suppose you have a quantum state of n qubits, and then we know that for a typical state, if we tried to express it in a standard basis, there would be an exponentially large number of terms, and there would be no succinct description of the state, and that's why quantum computers are hard to simulate. But on the other hand, if it were just a product state, if each one of the n parties had a pure state, then there would be a short description of the state with a number of parameters that just grows linearly with the number of parties. So you'd expect that if the state is not too highly entangled, there should still be a short description, and that's true. If the state has the property that for any way of dividing it into two parts, the bipartite entanglement is less than some constant, then there's a way of nearly factorizing the state, of writing out a succinct parameterization of the state in terms of Schmidt coefficients and stuff, which was worked out by Giffre Vidal recently. And furthermore, the processing of that state, as long as it retains this property of having bounded entanglement, can be simulated classically efficiently. If I do a gate, there's a simple way of updating this parameterization. And so that means that if I'm doing a quantum computation and at no time during the computation does the bipartite entanglement for any way of splitting the computer into two parts grow to be larger than a constant, then that quantum computation can be simulated efficiently by a classical computer. And this really drives home the point that everyone expects, that quantum computers derive their power from entanglement. Only by becoming sufficiently highly entangled can the state of a quantum computer be doing something that classical computers can't emulate easily. And we can also use this method for simulating efficiently on classical computers, say, the real-time evolution of a quantum spin chain, which has a finite correlation length, or even a critical spin chain, because for a critical spin chain, the bipartite entanglement grows, but only like the logarithm of the length of the chain, so that the bipartite entanglement grows sufficiently slowly for the simulation methods to be effective. Okay, so I've left very little time to say something about quantum error correction, which is too bad because it's a rich topic which has a lot to do with quantum many body physics. Quantum error correction is the idea that we can protect quantum states from damage and process them fault tolerantly. Of course, a quantum computer will surely interact with its surroundings, so there will be decoherence, which can lead to errors in the computation. And it's only because we've learned that if quantum information is encoded properly, that it can be protected from decoherence and other possible sources of error, that we have some confidence that large-scale quantum computers can be operated. So let me say a minute or two how quantum error correction works. If I have a state of n qubits and it's subjected to some error due to an interaction with the environment, I can model the error by a unitary transformation that acts on the system and the environment, and I can expand its action on the environment in terms of some complete basis of operators, which I could choose to be poly operators, tensor products of poly matrices acting on the n qubits, each associated with some appropriate state of the environment, where these states don't have to be mutually orthogonal or normalized. And the task of quantum error correction is to reverse this process so that we can recover the original unknown state psi in its undamaged state. And we might be able to succeed in doing that if the noise is sufficiently weak, if errors are sufficiently rare and not too strongly correlated. So it's natural to define the weight of a poly operator as the number of qubits out of the n on which it acts non-trivially. And what we should hope to do is to be able to reverse the damage for the poly operators of sufficiently low weight and hope that the high-weight poly operators appear in this expansion with a small amplitude so they won't be too important. So one way we can do the job, if we want to correct up to t errors in our block of n qubits, is to encode our quantum information in some subspace, a code subspace of the Hilbert space of n qubits. And we can choose that code space to have the property that any one of the errors that we want to be able to correct, let's say any one of these poly operators of weight up to t, when acting on the code space, give mutually orthogonal spaces. And that means that, in principle, it's possible to distinguish perfectly among those different errors that could have occurred and to determine which error occurred and then reverse it, since it's just some unitary transformation which we can reverse with the quantum computer. And the only point I wanted to make now, since I'm almost out of time, is that the states in the code space are very profoundly entangled states. Another way of saying what I just said is that I can consider all the poly operators up to weight 2t, and in a code that can correct t errors in a block of n, that means all of these poly operators acting on the code space give states which are orthogonal to the code space. And that means if I take the expectation value of any one of these poly operators in the code space, it vanishes, which means that if I can take any 2t qubits out of the block of n and I trace over the rest, its density operator is completely random. There's actually absolutely no information if I look at any 2t qubits out of the n about what the state is in the code space. And so we can actually, using methods of quantum coding theory, make maximally entangled states, meaning that building states that have the property that there are n parts, and I can trace over up to half of them, n over 2 of the parts, and the remaining density operator is still completely random. So, and furthermore, I can take any number of parts that's smaller than that, of course. It's kind of interesting that we can't build states that have that property, we can't build states that are quite so profoundly entangled as that. With qubits, we have to increase the dimension of the parts as we increase the number of parts to really get maximally entangled states. But we can do it if the dimension of each part is greater than the number of parts, and it helps if it's a prime number, because then we can use tricks from coding theory that use properties of polynomials over a finite field. I guess the in some ways the deepest idea about quantum error correction that's emerged, and the one that makes the strongest contact with quantum many-body physics, is the idea of topological storage of quantum information, that we can use topological degeneracy to hide quantum states from the environment. And well, I'm quite excited about the work that you've heard about already at this meeting by Lev Yaffe and collaborators for potentially realizing this idea of quantum storage through topological degeneracy in Josephson junction arrays. And it'll be quite interesting in the next couple of years to see if the idea of topological protection of quantum states can really be achieved in feasible devices. And really the most amazing idea in the field of fault tolerance and quantum error correction is Kataya's proposal, which I guess you heard about yesterday, for using non-abelian anions for fault-tolerant computation. We can make pairs of anions, we can do a quantum computation by braiding them in an appropriate way, and then bringing them together in pairs to see whether they'll annihilate, and read out the result according to which pairs annihilate and which ones don't. And if the anions have the right property, we can efficiently simulate any quantum computation by this method. And as long as we keep the anions far apart from one another, except at the beginning and the end, and we keep the temperature low, that computation is very well protected from decoherence. So one of the great challenges will be to see in the coming years whether this idea can be realized in devices that people can really build. One interesting question to ask always is, what's really the difference between classical and quantum behavior? And I think thinking about quantum computing gives us a rather sharp way of formulating the question. Because one of the most interesting things I've ever heard about the difference between a quantum system and a classical system is that a classical system can't simulate a quantum system efficiently. And in the setting of noisy quantum computers, we can potentially identify a boundary between the quantum phase and the classical phase of a noisy system. When the noise is sufficiently low, we can use ideas about quantum fault tolerance to simulate arbitrary quantum computations and unleash the full power of quantum computation. But if the noise is too high, then fault tolerance won't work, and we have a device which is no more powerful than a classical computer. And somewhere in between, there's a phase transition from a computationally powerful system to one that's no more powerful than classical. In the setting of topological storage, we were able to show that this boundary can, in a useful way, be connected with the boundary between the confinement phase and the superconducting phase of a gauge theory that has quenched randomness. And maybe I should have talked about that more, because it really has something to do with glassy states. In fact, it's related to the type of loop condensation that was mentioned in the previous talk. But I figured you'd already heard enough about topology and quantum computing at this meeting. I just wanted to make the point that this is a really interesting kind of phase transition, and there's a lot that we still don't understand about it and would like to. And the other thing I haven't left enough time for is the theme of quantum hardware, but I'd be remiss were I not to emphasize that part of what makes this field fun and exciting is all the experimental activity and all the arenas in which the opportunities are opening up for coherently manipulating quantum states with unprecedented precision. So the So let me just reiterate the main points. That in some ways I think we're just beginning to appreciate the implications, which are surprisingly rich, of the tensor product structure of Hilbert space, because that's really what underlies entanglement and is the principle behind the power of quantum algorithms and the success of quantum error correction. It's very important to understand just what the power of quantum computing is, and progress is being made. It's kind of slow but steady, and there are intriguing connections with the theory of spectral gaps in disordered quantum systems. We've learned a lot about bipartite quantum entanglement, both pure and mixed, in the last couple of years, We don't understand nearly as well how to characterize many-body entanglement, but there have been some valuable insights derived. And I feel that future advances in our understanding of quantum computing and information will be linked closely to insights concerning properties of quantum many-body systems and quantum phase transitions. Okay, so thanks for listening.